everybody. Welcome back. This is Food for Thought, Thoughts If It Were You, and this is your host, Neo Gentrix. Now, again, like I mentioned before, it is Black History Month. It is the month of February here in the United States, and much like everyone else, most people have started to forget that this month even exists. And for those who know about it and try to embrace it, little people actually know the history of it. In this episode, I'm going to cover 10 little known black history facts. I'm going to do that sporadically throughout the remaining weeks of the month on my upcoming podcast. So look forward to one this evening as well. And then one of the main things that I want you to look forward to and think about is my upcoming podcast on the history or origins of Black History Month, where it came from, why they created it in the first place. So there are 10 little-known black history facts that most people don't know. A lot of people know a lot about black history because a lot of literature and stuff have become available. But there's other little side note things that most people don't know occurred between, you know, the time the slaves were freed during Lincoln's administration or the time after the Civil War when the slaves were freed and they were allowed to basically go to the same schools and live in the same residential areas. They were treated as actual people, or so we thought. The movie 12 Years of Slavery pointed out that even though, how do I put this, they were free, not everybody still considered them to be free and still kept them as slaves or treated them as such. And basically, black people have been considered degenerates for years. Now, future generations have been raised to not see color, but it doesn't stop the whole cycle of prejudging someone, racial issues and so on and so forth. And me personally, having lived in an area that was, as you can say, racially inclined, where they thought that they were superior, and black people and any other minorities were basically inferior, I'm a little sensitive to certain things, but hey, you know, it makes you stronger. So let's go back and relive a couple of moments, or at least a couple of positive ones here and there, and see what you guys think. You know, history is often reduced to a handful of memorable moments and events, and in, you know, black history, those events are often courageous stories like those of the Underground Railroad, you know, and historic moments like the famous I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther Jr. But, you know, those are only a few of the significant and important events that most people should know and remember, you know. And, you know, in an effort to honor the expanse and the growing history and stuff that people didn't even know existed for this month, Black History Month was established by a way of a weekly celebration in February known as Negro History Week by the historian Carter G. Woodson. Now, but just as black history is more than just a month, so too are the numerous events and figures that are often overlooked during it. I want to go ahead and cover a couple of them. So we're going to take a short break here, and we'll get started. How about that? All right, everybody, and we're back. So everyone knows who Rosa Parks is, you know, the first lady to refuse to give up her seat in Montgomery, Alabama. Heads up, there were actually several women who came before her, and one of which was Claudette Colvin. In March, I do believe it was the 2nd, 1955, the 15-year-old schoolgirl refused to move to the back of the bus, and this took place 9 months before the Rosa Parks stand that launched the whole Montgomery bus boycott thing. Claudette had been studying black leaders like Harriet Tubman in her segregated schools, because at this time frame, those were still a big issue. Those conversations had led to discussions around the current day Jim Crow laws that they were all experiencing. When the bus driver ordered Claudette to, you know, get up, she refused. And I quote, she said, "It felt like Sojourner's Truth was on one side pushing me down, and Harriet Tubman was on the other side pushing me down. I couldn't get up." It's a fair analogy of that. Her stand didn't stop there, though. She was arrested and thrown in jail. She was one of the four women who challenged the segregation law in court. So if the Broder v. Gale became the court case that successfully overturned the bus segregation laws in both Montgomery and Alabama, then why has Claudette's story been largely forgotten? There's the question of the day. You know, at the time, though, the NAACP and other black organizations felt Rosa Parks made a better icon for the movement than a teenager. So, as an adult with the right look, Rosa Parks was also the secretary of the NAACP and was both well-known and respected. People would associate her with the middle class, and that would attract support for the cause. But the struggle to end segregation was often fought by young people, more than half of which were, well, you guessed it, women. Go figure. So just so y'all know, okay, I'm not anti-feminist or anything. I just want to point out that it wasn't just men who did this. There were some strong women too, and most of them mothers. And with a high respect for my own mother, you know, I'm all for it. Just thought I'd throw that out there. And we're back. I got some interesting news for you guys. Before we go to the next person, let me go back to one that's a little more well-known. Martin Luther King Jr. Everyone knows who this is. Excuse me. Everyone knows him for his iconic I Have a Dream speech. But what if I told you that there was something else that most people don't know about him? Let me do a little quick history on it. Shouldn't take no more than a minute. On Wednesday, August 28, 1963, 250,000 Americans united at the Lincoln Memorial for the final speech of the March on Washington. I'm pretty sure most of y'all are familiar with that. As Martin Luther King Jr. stood at the podium, you know, he eventually pushed his notes aside. The night before the march, Dr. King began working on his speech with a small group of advisors in the lobby of the Willard Hotel. The original speech was more political and less historic. According to Clarence B. Jones, you know, it did not include any references to dreams whatsoever. And after delivering the now famous line, "We are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream," Dr. King transformed his speech into a sermon. That's right. He improvised the rest of his speech. He started out the way he was supposed to, but he didn't finish it that way. On stage, near Dr. King's, singer Mahalia Jackson reportedly kept saying, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." And while no one, you know, will know if he heard her or not, it could likely have been the inspiration he needed. Dr. King then, you know, continued with the, "Even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It's a dream deeply rooted in the American dream." You know, and then the famous Baptist preacher preached on, adding, you know, repetition and outlining the specifics of his dream. And while this improvised speech given on that hot August day in 1963 was not considered a universal success immediately, you know, it is now recognized as one of the greatest speeches in American history. There's a lot more information on that online, but I just thought I'd go ahead and give you a little tidbit. While he started out his speech, according to the notes that he did create with these people, the rest of it was all on the fly. When you have true passion for something and you really care about it, sometimes it's better just to say what's on your mind and think about it later. Not all the time is this true, but it did work out for him at the time frame. And while, yeah, it wasn't popular at the moment, look how it turned out years later. So yeah, sometimes being innovative is a good thing, even if it does make people hate you. All right, everybody, let's go ahead and move on. So, Here's an interesting tidbit. I know a lot of people have talked about how we have inoculations and, you know, different types of medicines and what's to fight off different diseases and such. But how would you feel if I told you that a slave was a slave person, I'm not going to say whether it was a man or a boy or whatever, was actually the first to introduce America to inoculations? There's a thought for you. A little food for thought. A few details are known about, you know, the birth of this person. His name is, let's see if I can't, try not to butcher this name too much. Onesimus. Onesimus, I guess. I'm going to go with that. But it is assumed he was basically born in Africa in the late 17th century before eventually landing in Boston. Okay. One of the 1,000 people of African descent living in Massachusetts colony. The boy was a gift to the Puritan church ministry, minister Cotton Mather. I know the name and I said it wrong. From his congregation in 1706. He told Mather about the centuries-old tradition of inoculation practice in Africa. By extracting the material from an infected person and scratching it into the skin of an uninfected person, you could deliberately induce smallpox to a healthy individual, making them basically, well, immune. Considered extremely dangerous at the time, though, Cotton Mather convinced Dr. How does this guy's name pronounce? See, I wrote these down because I can't remember them. Zabdiel Bolston, I'm going to go with that, to experiment with the procedure when a smallpox epidemic hit Boston in 1721. And over 250 people were inoculated. Opposed politically, religiously, and medically in the United States and abroad, public reaction to the experiment put Mather and Boylston's lives in, how do I put this, in simple terms, dire danger. That's a better way to put that. Despite records indicating that only 2% of the patients requesting inoculation died compared to the 15% who of people not inoculated who contracted smallpox. If only 2% of your patients died from the inoculation and over 250 of them actually survived, versus 15% of them constantly getting it and then dying, I'd say your trials were a success at this point, but, you know, people didn't believe that. The boy's traditional African practice was used to inoculate American soldiers during the Revolutionary War and introduced the concept of inoculation to America, though not completely accepted at the time. Look where we're at now. I guess you can say that it's kinda been a thing for us for a long time. And it's a little bit our fault. Hey, I'm not done yet. Hold on a second. I got another one for you. So the earliest record protest against slavery was by the Quakers in 1688. Go figure, huh? You know, they're also known as the Society of Friends. Well, that's a pretty well-known history fact right there. You know, they have a long history of abolition. But it was four Pennsylvania friends from Germantown who wrote the initial protest in the 17th century. Go figure. They saw the slave trade as a grave injustice against their fellow man and used the Golden Rule to argue against it, such inhumane treatment, regardless of the person's skin color. This is where this whole, you know, regardless of what their skin color, they're still human thing came from. You know, basically it said, we should do unto others as we have done unto ourselves in their protest. That's basically how they started, you know. Pray, what thing in the world can be done worse towards us than if a man should rob and steal us away, and sell us for slaves to some strange countries, separating husbands from their wives and children? And when you think about it like that, you know, it kind of makes you wonder. Yeah, okay, they're slaves because they're black. That's great. How would you feel if you were in their situation? You know, and don't answer the question saying, well, I'm not in their situation. Stop for a minute and think, if you were, or if the world flipped and you were the minority, how would you feel being treated like that, beaten like that, sold like that, told you were nothing more than a dog? Their protest against slavery and human trafficking was presented at monthly meetings in Dublin and Philadelphia. The Dublin monthly meeting reviewed the protest but sent it to the quarterly meeting, feeling it to be too serious an issue for their own meetings to decide. The four friends continued their efforts and presented it at the Philadelphia yearly meeting, but it wasn't until 88 years later that the Society of Friends officially denounced slavery. Still, though, I give them points for at least trying. You know, over the centuries, the rare document has been considered lost twice, but most recently it was rediscovered in 2005 and is now at the Haverford College Special Collections. So if you wanted to go there, you could check out the original document that showed that they were basically against slavery the entire time. Hey, so let's move on to the next one. So here's a tidbit. Now, this is something that actually should be pretty more well-known than the last one. Did you know that of the 25.5 million Africans that were shipped to the New World during the transatlantic slave trade, of that group, only 388,000 actually arrived at the United States? In the late 15th century, the advancement of seafaring technologies created a new Atlantic that would change the world forever. As ships began connecting West Africa with Europe and the Americas, new fortunes were sought and native populations were decimated. With the native labor force dwindling and demand for plantation and mining labors growing, the transatlantic slave trade basically began from that. The transatlantic slave trade was underway from the 1500s to 1866, when it was, stopped, shipping more than 12 million African slaves across the world. And of those slaves, only 10.7 million survived the dreaded Middle Passage, as they called it. Over 400 years, the majority of the slaves, 4.9 million, found their way to Brazil, where they suffered incredibly high mortality rates due to terrible work conditions. Brazil was also the last country to ban slavery, and that took place in 1888, believe it or not. So even after America done stop, they were still doing it. By the time the United States became involved in the slave trade, though, it had been underway for 200 years. The majority of its 388,000 slaves arrived between the years 1700 and 1866, representing a smaller percentage than most Americans realized. It wasn't as big a group as everyone initially thought that was here in America. Actually, it was a lot smaller. And when you think about the size of the state of Texas, which holds well over a couple million people, 388,000 slaves does not seem like a lot of people. Hell, I'm pretty sure you could put that many people in the center of downtown Houston, which isn't very big, by the way. The inside of the 360 loop, and leave them there. That would be pretty much the percentage of African slaves that actually made it over here. You know, and that's not the only thing. Let me go ahead and throw something else into this one. The diverse history of black historical colleges and universities. You know, while Jewish and African American communities have a tumultuous shared history when it comes to pursuit of civil rights, there's a chapter that's often overlooked as a result of this. In the 1930s, when Jewish academics from Germany and Australia were dismissed for their teaching positions, many came to the United States looking for jobs. And due to the Depression, xenophobia, and rising antisemitism, I hate this word, many found it difficult to find work. More than 50 found positions at HBCUs in the segregated South. Originally established to educate free slaves to read and write, the first historical black colleges and universities was Cheney University in Pennsylvania, established in 1837. You can go look that one up yourself. It's actually pretty well known. By the time the Jewish professors arrived, the number of HBCUs had grown to 78, and at the time, both Jews and African Americans were persecuted. Jewish professors in the black colleges found the environment comfortable and accepting, and often creating special programs to provide opportunities to engage blacks and whites in meaningful conversation, often for the first time, because, let's just put it this way, they didn't like each other too much. In the years that followed, the interest of Jewish and African-American communities increased increasingly diverged. But this once shared experience of discrimination and interracial cooperation remained a key part of the civil rights movement after that. So despite the slaves being brought over here, and at one point working together with the Jews to actually make a better environment for us here, which then ended later, segregation was still a major problem. So there's that. Okay. So that last one was probably a given. Let's try something a little bit different here. Let's talk about the cowboys for a second. One in every four cowboys was actually black, believe it or not. Considering the time frame in which everything was occurring, by the time cowboys and things like that nature was actually becoming a bigger thing, think about it. Slavery had almost been completely abolished. And despite the stories told in popular books and movies, you know, in fact, it's believed that the real Lone Ranger that everyone talks about was actually inspired by an African American man, by the name of, I do believe it's Bass Reeves, or it could be Bass, I could be wrong. He was born a slave, but escaped west during the Civil War, where he lived in what was now then known as the Indian Territory. He eventually became a deputy U.S. Marshal. See, we can hold positions too. Was a master of disguise, an expert marksman, had a Native American companion, and rode a silver horse. His story was not unique, however. In the 19th century, the Wild West drew enslaved blacks with the hope of freedom and wages. When the Civil War ended, freedmen came west with the hope of better life, where, you know, the demand for skilled labor was high. These African Americans made up at least a quarter of the legendary cowboys who lived dangerous lives facing weather, rattlesnakes, outlaws, you know, while they slept under the stars driving cattle herds to market. You know, the same stuff that you would hear. They actually did it. While there was little formal segregation in frontier towns and a great deal of personal freedom, black cowboys were often expected to do more of the work and the roughest jobs compared to their white counterparts. Loyalty did develop between cowboys on a drive, but the black cowboys were typically responsible for breaking the horses and being the first ones to cross flooded streams during cattle drives. In fact, it was believed that the term cowboy originated as a derogatory term used to describe black cowhands, as they were basically known. And just so you know, I am actually not racist. I couldn't care less. I just thought that I'd at least make this information known, since very few people know about this. I mean, I know about it, but I don't know. I just feel like I should share it. Ooh, and I got one more for you, too. Actually, let's take a short break and I'll cover it. So, you know how cartoons and TV shows tend to make fun of different things, and we find them interesting and funny, you know, like Popeye the Sailor Man, or Bugs Bunny, and such of that nature. I wonder how many people remember the TV show Betty Boop. You know, the weird-looking girl that's on stage singing and kind of looks like a slut. Well, as it turns out, the TV show was created at the same time frame as a lot of other incidents that were taking place at the same time. There was a girl lady who was known as the, as they say, real Betty Boop. Her name was Esther Jones. True enough to its name, the iconic cartoon character Betty Boop was inspired by the black jazz singer in Harlem. Introduced by cartoonist Max Fletcher in 1930, the caricature of the jazz age flapper was the first and most famous sexual symbol in animation. Betty Boop is best known for her revealing dress, curvous figure, signature vocals, boop boop badoop, or however she says that. I don't really care for the show too much. While there has been controversy over the years, the inspiration has been traced back to Esther Jones, who was known as Baby Esther, and performed regularly in the Cotton Club during the 1920s. Her trademark vocal style of using boops and other childlike scat sounds attracted the attention of actress Helen Kane during a performance in the late 1920s. And after seeing Baby Esther, Helen Kane adopted her style and began using boops in her songs as well. Finding fame early on, Helen Kane often included this baby style into her music. So when Betty Boop was introduced, Kane promptly sued Fletcher and Paramount Public Corporation, stating that they were using her image and style. However, video evidence came to light of Baby Esther's performance in a nightclub, and the courts ruled against Helen Kane, stating she did not have the exclusive rights to the booping style or image, as that the style is in fact predating her. Baby Esther's baby style did bring her mainstream fame and died. It did bring her mainstream fame though, but she did die in relatively obscurity. But after that, but a piece of her lives, piece of her life still lives on in that iconic character Betty Boop, regardless of how it looks. Let's just go with it that way. All right, let's move on. I got a new one for you. So, you know how there's a lot of licensed pilots in the United States, and a lot of them pretty well known? Well, as it turns out, there's a lady born in Atlanta, Texas, who was also known as the first African-American female pilot who was licensed in the United States. And she goes by the name Bessie Coleman, to be correct. She was born in Atlanta, Texas in 1892. She grew up in a world of harsh poverty, discrimination, segregation, you know, like most of the women and men that did back then. She moved to Chicago at the age of 23 to seek her fortune, but found little opportunity there as well. You know, wild tales of flying exploits from World War I soldiers first inspired her to explore aviation. But she faced a double stigma in that dream, being both African American and, well, a woman. However, despite this, she set her sights on France in order to reach her dream and began studying in France. In 1920, she crossed the ocean with all her savings and financial support of Robert Abbott, one of the first African American millionaires. Now, there's a podcast episode for a later date. Over the next 7 months, she learned to fly in June of 1921. The Fédération Aéronautique Internationale awarded her an international pilot's license, allowing her to fly worldwide. Wildly celebrated upon her return to the United States, reporters turned out in droves to basically greet her, because this was an unheard of thing. She was the first African American, or black lady, just to put it bluntly, to ever achieve this. She performed a numerous amount of air shows over the next 5 years after that. She performed heart-thrilling stunts, encouraging other African Americans to pursue flying, and refusing to perform where blacks were not admitted. When she tragically died in a plane accident, though, in 1926, famous writers and equal rights advocate Ida B. Wells presided over her funeral. An editorial in the Dallas Express stated that There is reason to believe that the general public did not completely sense the size of her contribution to the achievements of the quote-unquote race as such. In other words, while they did document the entire thing, they didn't really deem it worthy enough to be put forward as mainstream news for education purposes. However, it was known that she did completely do something that no one has ever done, and was rewarded for it. And despite all of this, she still stood for what she believed in. Any area that didn't allow black people to come to the show, she wouldn't perform, as she was not for racial discrimination. Keep that in mind. All right, everyone. Now for the last thing that I'm going to cover in this podcast. Hehe. Well, nowadays, this is not so much of a problem, but I thought I'd at least bring it up. You know how no matter where you go, you now see people intermarry with different races? You'll see black and Hispanic, you'll see a Hispanic and white, you'll even see Asians mixed in a bunch. And it's a common thing now, it's not a big deal. Well, believe it or not, interracial marriage in the United States was banned in 1964, and they didn't overturn it until 1967. And, you know, during the 17th and early 18th century, the growing numbers of interracial marriages, also known as miscegenation between blacks and whites, led the passage of this new law. The first anti-miscegenation law enacted was in the colony of Maryland in 1664, and additional colonies quickly followed suit. These marriages were prohibited, and penalties included enslavement, exile, or imprisonment of the white perpetrators. These laws grew and evolved over the years, and attempts were even made to modify the Constitution to ban interracial marriages altogether in all states. It would take 300 years for this law to be completely overturned in 1967, where a man named Richard Loving, a white man, and Mildred Jeter, a black woman, were married in the District of Columbia. When they returned home to Virginia, they were arrested and convicted of violating the state's miscegenation law. They each faced a year in jail, and then their case went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, however, found favor of the Lovings, and in the famous trial Loving versus Virginia, they ruled that prohibiting interracial marriages on state and local levels was unconstitutional. And this meant that marriages between the races were legal in the country for the first time since 1664. However, in 2000, the year 2000, Alabama became the last state to officially legalize interracial marriages by removing the unenforceable ban that was still contained in their state constitution. Believe it or not. Yeah, I know. As simple as this thing seems, it's a lot easier said than done. People just don't change overnight. And a lot of these incidents took someone with immense amount of courage and willing to take a huge risk and or gamble with not only their life but the lives of people around them in order to make these changes, happen. These are things that people need to take into mind and consideration when they think of months like Black History Month or whatever. Think about its real meaning. Think about what its purpose could mean. Think about what the people who came before you did to make it happen. Well, that's it for this podcast, guys. Like always, if you like what you hear, support this podcast on the anchor.fm/neogentrixsite. Or if you have any comments, concerns, or things you wish that I could cover, hit me up on my Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or Snapchat. Like always, this is Food for Thought, Thoughts If It Were You. I'm Neo Gentrix. I'll catch you guys later.